Good morning. I'd like to call to order the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. The time is 5 minutes after 8, and it is the 10th of March. Today we have Sarah Fisher Goad and Brian Carey with AEA, the Alaska Energy Authority. This presentation was put together at the request of committee members to look at the Susitna Hydro project and also have a discussion about the pros and cons of Susitna versus the Chacachamna project. And here today are Brian and Sarah, and they'll go ahead and give the presentation, then we'll have questions at the end. And here today are Representatives Sadler, Osterman, Foster, and myself, Chair Munoz. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. I had the easy task today to turn the presentation over to Mr. Carey to go over the large hydro project process that we've gone through since November. So with that,
thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Carey, Alaska Energy Authority, technical engineer. Okay. Did you record that? Okay. I'm going to go over the preliminary decision document that was put out by Alaska Energy Authority last November, and it shows a comparison between the two possible major hydroelectric projects along the rail belt, a project on the Susitna River at Watauna and at Chacachamna. Okay. Just a little bit of quick history. Alaska Energy Authority started out as Alaska Power Authority back in 1976. We currently own Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project and the Alaska Intertie. Bradley Lake is the largest hydroelectric project in the state at 120 megawatts. And the Alaska Intertie connects Alaska and the interior so that during times of power shortages, or actually not so much power shortages, you can switch the energy between the interior and Alaska and Anchorage area. So during the winter, we use gas-generated electricity, which is a lower cost than what interior can generate at, and send it up north. And then if there's to be an outage or power problems down the Anchorage area, certainly power can come down from the interior to the Anchorage area. So major programs that we have, Renewable Energy Fund, Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency, Rural Energy Upgrades, which include both the bulk fuel tank farms, powerhouses, and small hydro projects. So we've been building various energy projects, for the most part, in rural Alaska for the last decade or two. So more recent history, last couple of years, there's been quite a lot of concern about gas deliverability and rising fuel prices, and also the most of the major generation and transmission projects in the rail belt are going to be needing to be replaced in the coming years, in the coming decade or so. And so both the state and utilities came up with an integrated resource plan, and that's to look at the possible demands in the future for electricity along the rail belt, and also how that electricity is going to be provided through gas, coal, oil, hydro, wind, solar, modular nuclear. So coming out of the integrated resource plan, this slide shows one possible future for the rail belt. It's a 50-year time horizon. Off on the left-hand side, the axis shows what we're currently at around the current annual generation and need for the rail belt. It shows a little bit of a dip in there, which is actually from energy efficiency improvements, and so the demand's going to decrease a little bit. A couple of the takeaways on this slide is, one, is you can see all the purple down there, that's natural gas generation, so no matter what, we're still going to be generating a substantial amount of energy from gas. In this case, it tends to show a large amount of hydro coming online in 2025, which would be one of the two possible large hydroelectric projects. Up at the top, it has the gold area, which would be the geothermal, and this one actually doesn't show much wind, but wind was evaluated, and when you start looking at different model runs, some of the model runs have wind and some don't, so it just depends on the integrated resource plans looked at all those possible generation ones, and depending on what simulation came out, it has different percentages for the future of what generation would be the lowest cost options. So the two possible large hydroelectric projects that could help satisfy the demand would be the Susitna project at Watonna or the Chacachama project. There's other possible large hydroelectric projects along the Susitna River, and they were discarded in an earlier stage, certainly during the 70s or 80s, because of greater fish concerns. There are other possible small hydroelectric projects along the rail belt, but some of those projects may go forward. Others may not, just because of the cost of construction and transmission.
Excuse me. Let's show on the record that we have been joined by Representative Gardner. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. So the presentation today will be much more focusing on the preliminary decision document, which is a risk analysis of the two large projects, Chacachama and Watonna, and compares and contrasts them much more. First, start out talking a little bit about fish. This is the whole Susitna River Basin area. The red is the salmon spawning areas based on fish and game radial telemetry studies during the last couple of years. It does not show the Chinook. We had 1980s, they investigated the area by Watonna for several years and did not find any salmon at that time. More recently, in 2003, they found some juvenile Chinook salmon, which is above Watonna. However, by far, most of the salmon, probably 99.9% of the salmon, are below the dam site and tend to go to these different red spawning areas. It shows red along the Susitna River because there's some sloughs that they go in, but there again, those tend to be not as productive as some of the tributary streams. A large amount of the salmon go up some of the other rivers, such as the Yintna River, Talkeetna River, and some of the other ones to spawn in other environments. So there's very little salmon up at the Watonna site. Salmon are definitely below, and there would have to be modifications of how you operate the reservoir or how you operate the project to ensure that the salmon downstream are not impacted. Chacachama is located about 85 miles to the west of Anchorage. Just to the west of it is Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. And then with the river that comes out of the lake currently, Chacachama River, it goes through the Trading Bay State Game Refuge. It's a glacier-dammed lake, and so the glacier is kind of acting as the dam to hold the water back in. The proposal would be to bring a tunnel of approximately 10 to 12 miles through the one range of mountains and empty the water out into the MacArthur River Basin. One of the problems you get with a project like this is you need to be reducing the water flow through the existing river, the Chacachama River, to gain energy. So the less water you have, to get more energy, you have to reduce it more. But if you reduce the water through the existing river, it means that one, adult salmon may not be able to make it up. Two is juvenile salmon may not make it up. The only way that they could get down to the stream, to the Cook Inlet, may be going through the powerhouse tunnel. And if you reduce the water flow through there, the state game refuge may also see substantial changes, because right now there's a lot of wetlands. And if you no longer have the water flow coming in, a lot of that could be drying out and changing the character away from the wetlands to perhaps moose browse or otherwise. It's uncertain. The red on this slide shows where what is known or suspected spawning areas from studies back in the 1980s. The spawning areas on the to the left of the lake or to the west of the lake, there's a run of, during that time, it was at least 40,000 red or sockeye salmon that went through to that area. Some of the important parts that's to remember is you've got, with the national park over here, all the resource agencies have what's called mandatory conditioning ability. Well, authors of a FERC license. So from that standpoint, they can put conditions into your hydropower license. And for the most part, you don't have a choice about it. If you want that hydropower license, they can put conditions about how much flow is going to go down the existing river, and not only how much flow is going to go down, what time of the year. And so they can tell you if it's all going to come down during the summer, during the winter time, or which. And those flows would be the environmental flows to maintain the fisheries or other wildlife. I'll just mention one other little part about with the national park off to the west of it. Is the national park, their boundary line goes through what's called Kinabuna Lake. And the national park has already sent a letter to FERC indicating that they're concerned that Lake Kinabuna and Lake Chacachama are what would be called as hydrologically connected. If it is determined that the two lakes are connected, it means that any change in the water level with Lake Chacachama would affect Lake Kinabuna and the park. And FERC cannot license a hydropower project if it is affecting the park that way. The only way you could get the project licensed would be through a direct act of Congress. And just other mentioned there, of course, it doesn't completely show, but at the head of Block 8 Glacier is Mount Spur, the volcano, which is a little bit active.
We have a question from Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking for the name of the lake that may be connected, and I don't see it written anywhere. Could you spell it? Or come close.
Madam Chair, I believe it was Lake Kinabuna. I believe it's spelled K-E-N-B-U-N-N-A.
Thank you.
So as, before we go on to the next slide, the important part is this type of a project is important because of the diversion that you're doing from one river system over to another river system, and you have to remain flows into the existing river system for the salmon or other aquatics. So a, kind of a quick recap on terms of the environmental between the two projects. Susitna Watana, the reservoir would be approximately 39 miles long, maximum 2 miles wide. Most of it would not be 2 miles wide, but would be more narrow than that. 10 years ago, I would have said that it's above all salmon, but since the 2003 found some juveniles, the best I can say on it is above significant salmon. Right now, Fish and Game will be doing more studies, and that will be part of the data gaps that we're doing to figure out exactly how many salmon do make it up there. So far as we know, it's only Chinook, and it's believed to be just several hundred from the earlier studies. There would be some wildlife habitat that would be lost because of the inundation of water. Fisheries impacts, I'm going to say it's minimal fisheries impact. It will be studied more, but for the most part, you're looking at impacts which would be downstream, and some of those impacts can be positive, along with some would be negative. In general, before it goes forward, because of the conditioning on the license by the resource agencies, they're going to be making sure that any fisheries impacts are going to be compensated through mitigation or other measures. Chacachama has significant salmon populations that travel through the lake to the national park. It's believed that they also spawn within the lake, along with the lake trout, Dolly Varden and whitefish are all present right now in the lake. If you try drawing the lake down during the wintertime that you do at a lake tap, it could be that some of the spawning bed areas get frozen out. A significant part is the diversion of the water and the change of habitat in the state game refuge. There's concerns about the adults. One is because of false attraction would tend to go up the MacArthur River Valley to the powerhouse location. So how do you get them back into the lake at that point? And then you still have the problem of even if you could catch all the adults and truck them up to the lake, generally for the smolt when they get ready to go back to the sea, the smolt tend to follow the most current that they find. And the most current, if you're operating a powerhouse, is going down the power tunnel. And so how do you deal with the juveniles to make sure they get back to the sea without any impacts? And as I mentioned earlier, you may not be able to license it under FERC.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
And you said that we may not be able to license it under FERC because it has the potential to divert water from one river system to another?
Madam Chair, the part about licensing under FERC is if a hydropower project would be affecting a national park. And so from that standpoint, it's not the diversion that's the license problem. It's that if Lake Kinibuna is connected hydrologically to Chacachamna, then you'd be affecting the park.
Thank you. But we don't exactly know if it is or not. We think it might be.
The letter from, Madam Chair, the letter from National Park Service indicated that they would want that to be investigated prior to any other investigations that would occur.
Thank
you. So the installed capacity for Susitna would be approximately 600 megawatts. Average energy, which you always got to remember that with the hydro, it depends on terms of the rain and snow melt each year, is around 2,600 gigawatt hours, which is close to 50% of what the annual rail belt energy is right now. Any one year, you could be plus or minus 10 or 15% from that number of what you're going to receive. In the case of Chacachamna, the installed capacity that was put in the preliminary permit application was 300 megawatts. If you start taking a look at with the environmental flows, which subtract away from the energy, you're more likely coming up with an average energy of maybe 860 to 1100 gigawatt hours per year. That number you will not know until you've probably spent 5 years or more studying the project to better understand the fisheries and wildlife. At those numbers, you're down around 20% of what the annual rail belt energy would be. This slide shows just an approximate annual rail belt energy on a monthly basis going through the year. We tend to peak during the winter months and have lower during the summer. What's important about the hydro projects, or you know, especially currently Bradley Lake Hydro, is it can produce a lot of energy during the winter months when gas is in a, when there's less ability of gas wells to deliver the gas. So you'll see on here one is during the months of July, August, it peaks up really high. And one of the reasons for that is you need to be letting a large amount of water flow go down the river as a normal river flow would be. And so you're not holding back all the summertime flow. You're holding back summertime flow, but you're still going to have the high summer flows. In the case of certainly Susitna, all the summertime flow is going to go through the powerhouse, and so that's why you're getting a large amount of energy. Chacachamna would also have the large summertime flows too. But during the wintertime, it tends to separate out the projects much more so. With Chacachamna, you've got limited storage because there would be no dam construction at that outlet of the lake. So one of the things that you do is you'd have less than 50 megawatts during the wintertime, perhaps down to 50 megawatts. You know, if you're only looking at 50 megawatts during the wintertime, that's not going to help the gas situation very much. Whereas the generation off of Susitna would be more than 200 megawatts. So it'd still be a substantial portion of the generation requirements in the wintertime. A couple other parts on here is just that, you know, the amount of energy that would be produced by the projects would be less than what the rail belt currently uses. So it tends to be replacing existing power generation projects that we've had around since the 1980s or 70s. And it's still the increment of energy and power can still be absorbed by the utilities. And I will say, too, is because those projects will go away, regardless if you build a hydro or not, such as Watan or Chacachamna, utilities and a certain extent the state is going to have to spend billions of dollars in the coming couple of decades to replace aging infrastructure. It's alters up with the integrated resource plan with the different looks at what the future will be. There are still billions of dollars that must be spent regardless. Nope. I mentioned Bradley Lake Hydroelectric. This is a quick slide of it. One possible way of constructing Wetana would be to build it similar to Bradley Lake Hydroelectric as an embankment dam. You can see in the slide there's actually no fish ladder because Bradley doesn't have any fish at this point. However, you do see water coming out of the bottom. That's for, that would be the environmental flows, the fish flows for where the salmon are down next to the inlet. It's generally thought by a lot of people that were present with the Bradley Lake prior to the dam being built that there's actually been positive fisheries impacts by Bradley Lake Hydro on the salmon down by the inlet, that there are more salmon than there was prior to the dam being built. And the other parts about Bradley, which are important to know, is the financing. It was pretty much, on most hydroelectric projects are not necessarily going to have the cheapest power for the first possibly 10 years of the life. So Bradley was built with half the money at the start was pretty much state money. The other half was financed through bonds. Utilities pay off the bonds. And once the utilities have paid off those bonds, then their payments will continue, only that money will be going back to the state instead to help repay the state for some of the state's investment in Bradley. The other standpoint about Bradley is its cost of power right now is substantially less than a lot of the rest of the generation on the rail belt. So just on the basis of the generation cost being less, rail belt consumers are saving, because of Bradley, probably getting close to $10 million a year based on what they'd have to be generating by other means instead of having the hydroelectric power. It's also just very critical with the wintertime power, is that if we didn't have Bradley able to provide power during the wintertime, South Central would be in a much greater problem in regards to gas situation as of this winter versus next winter.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I've heard that over time all dams will silt up regardless of around the nation. Is that happening with Bradley Lake, and how long would we expect that to function or we to address the silting?
Madam Chair, all dams over time will, but it may be the time scale is pretty long. I haven't seen any numbers on Bradley. I don't think we've seen any indication to this point. And so the time scale with Bradley, I believe, would tend to be hundreds of years. In the case of a dam at Wetana, the estimate for the full Wetana height of 885 foot during the 1980s was greater than 1,000 years before there'd be enough silt to impact the operations. In the case of being that we'd be looking at a lower height dam right here, the time period would be less, but it'd still be on the order of magnitude of hundreds of years before silt would affect it.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for you, Brian. The issue of the turbines, is any of the water source at Bradley Lake glacial in origin?
Madam Chair, yes. Probably out of Bradley Lake's water, approximately we just think of a third of it is from rainfall, a third of it is from snowfall, and a third of it is from existing glacial melt. And so you've got Kashmak Glacier and Nuka Glacier that are both providing water to it. And so the lake is definitely a silty lake. It's up there. It's good, nice gray color. And glaciers have a significant input into the lake.
Follow-up, we had some concern expressed from folks in Talkeetna about whether glacial silt or any rocky matter would cause damage to turbines. Has there been any – what's been the service life of the turbines at Bradley Lake, and has there been damage from glacial silt?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there have been hydroelectric facilities down the Andes that are closer to being run to the river where they tend to have large – particle sizes, which then will tend to wear down the turbines. This has also occurred at, I know, at King Cove Hydro, where they've had a problem because it's almost like run a river. In the case of Bradley Lake, we haven't seen any wear at this point, and that's just because of both Bradley Lake and what would be one of the other hydro projects. The reservoir is large enough that all the heavy particles will drop out fairly soon after it gets into lake, and so what will end up going through the turbines will be much more the flour, which is not quite as abrasive and doesn't wear on the turbines quite as much. Okay. So Bradley's been operating for 20 years, and we haven't had any problems in regards to the turbines, in regards to the silt.
Okay. And one more follow-up, if I could. I know that everyone wants answers right now to every question they might have, but do you have any estimate, even a rough estimate, of the relative silt-carrying capacity of the sources of water for the Wautauna? In other words, how much is glacial melt, how much would be rainfall, how much would be snow melt?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that was actually studied back in the 1980s. Mm. I'm sure we'd be having additional studies at this point. However, the Alaska Range valleys were producing, I believe, around 50% of the water going to Wautauna. Now, for the exact amount of how much is each year's snow melt versus what percent of it is from the glaciers actually where the ice is melting away, I'm not quite sure of that percentage. It's just the Alaska Range valleys have the large input to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
I actually was going to ask the exact same question.
All right.
Thank you.
Great minds think alike.
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes, go
will ahead. We have that information at some point? Has that study been done?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, it will be done. The FERC licensing process is very extensive, and they require studies on about everything. And so we would be updating all the studies in regards to the water sources. One of the things that we'd have to be looking at, too, is climate change. And so that would be studied out in terms of how quick are the glaciers being changed up there and what are future projections. And so that will be studied in the coming years.
Representative Osterman has a question.
On your slide here, was Bradley, the water that's coming out the bottom down there, that's the powerhouse, that's where the turbine's at?
Representative Osterman, through the chair. No, what's coming out the bottom is only the fish water releases. The powerhouse for Bradley is located 3.5 miles away from the dam, and so it's the intake is approximately 150 feet down below what the lake level is here. And it goes through a power tunnel, which is 3.5 miles long, down to tidewater. And so with the powerhouse being at tidewater, you get the difference between the lake and tidewater of approximately 1,100 feet. And so that's what you've got, your flow, but that 1,100-foot difference puts the water under a tremendous amount of pressure. So.
Okay. My second question, in the Wautauna, in relationship to Bradley, this size of what we see as a dam here on Bradley, what is the span across where they're going to dam or have to dam at Wautauna? And what is where would the powerhouse be in relationship to the dam there? Because if I understand correctly, Wautauna is a fall. There's a, and assuming the powerhouse will be down below the falls.
Representative Osterman, through the chair. The length of the crest of the dam for either dam, I do not remember at this time. I tend to remember what the elevation of the dam is. Bradley is 125 feet. Wautauna would be 700 foot. However, now that 700 foot, approximately, I don't know, 125 foot is below ground, so you could bring it down to the bedrock. So the area which is above the water, tail water, might be around 550 feet. The location of the powerhouse in the 1980s was to be an underground powerhouse off to the side of the dam and downriver, and so it'd be going through a power tunnel kind of around the dam. If we were to build the dam using roller compacted concrete, the powerhouse would be more at the base of the dam, would likely not be an underground powerhouse. It's, we probably would not want to put it directly on the dam. And the reason why is if you put it directly on the dam, you would be confining yourself in for future. You would not have the ability to raise the height in the dam at a future date if the powerhouse is right next to the dam. So you'd want to keep it far enough away, and that way it just gives you the options that at a future date, if you wanted to, you could always go in and raise the dam more.
Madam Chair, in Kodiak, when they built the hydroelectric project at Terror Lake there, they put in two turbines, and but they put a slot in for the third one if it was needed in the future. Is that part of the planning process here to be able to expand Wantana and more power from it at some point in time?
Representative Osborne, through the chair, for the original design of Wantana, if it was an embankment dam, and then it was to have an underground powerhouse, one of the ideas behind it was if they do it underground, they would make the cavern large enough so that you could have future turbines. And so that way, at a future date, you could go in, raise the dam, and you'd already have the powerhouse size for adding the additional turbines to it. If you have it on an external powerhouse, then it's a little bit easier to, there'd still be changes to it, so it'd give you the possibility you could put future turbines in. It's a little bit easier because you could add on to the existing building easier than versus going underground and blast out more area. So I'll say that it would be designed such that we'd leave open the ability to add turbines at a future date.
Good morning, Representative Sisma. Thank you. Okay, please continue. Mm-hmm.
Possible timeline for licensing for both projects. Wantana, first off, we are not currently on this timeline at all. This is the timeline of once you start getting into the formal FERC process, and we are not on that timeline at all. So, Wantana, you could probably prepare and file the final application for license about 3.5 years. And so that after around 6.5 years, you could be moving forward to construction and receive first power in approximately 11 years. Chacachalma has thought that it would require more time at the start in regards to FERC to do the licensing, because one is there's already for CSITNA, there's been just during the 1980s 3,500 documents done on CSITNA in regards to environmental and other effects. Chacachalma has very little done on it, and it's a much more complicated system because in the case of CSITNA, the water stays down the basin, whereas in the case of Chacachalma, you've got that diversion, so you've got to deal with how is it going to affect the national park and state game refuge and both river systems. So because of that, it's likely that it's going to require much more studies and more time at FERC. The construction time period at Chacachalma would probably be a little bit longer too. To drill tunnel through 10 to 12 miles takes a substantial amount of time, and before you can do that for both projects, you've got to get access to the point, and you've got a couple of years of access building to get in there. So first power at Chacachalma would be more likely around 14 years from now, or at least 14 years from the time you start the process.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to note, too, I know there are some legislators who, when they're in D.C. for Energy Council, came back and earlier this week, I've heard from several who had meetings with FERC that there is somewhat more of an optimistic licensing schedule of 2 to 3 years. And I have relayed that to Brian, and we haven't had an opportunity to talk to MWH with respect to that. However, we plan on having some conversations with FERC with respect to a more aggressive timeline and where, you know, that difference is. So we're not prepared to update what we think a timeline would be yet. However, we found that encouraging that perhaps maybe there's a somewhat of a faster licensing process. So I just wanted to note that we're cautiously optimistic that we hopefully can see something faster than this schedule.
Okay. Thank you. And for the record, that was Sarah Fisher Goad. And we have a question from Representative Foster.
Yes, and actually a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Both Representative Sadler and I were part of the team that went and spoke with FERC, and I also got the same impression. It was very, of course, high-level conversation, but I was under the impression that, they were saying, more of the issues might lie with, some of the agencies and departments, but from their standpoint, I got the feeling that they seemed optimistic about things, so. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Please continue. Thank you.
So this will be the last slide, and then I could also address some of the questions that came up during some of the public workshops that we held about the preliminary decision document. So a little bit of comparison between the two projects. Watauga would be producing more energy. It's maybe 2.5 times as much energy. And because the cost may be less than double what the other, all the energy would be at a lower cost per unit of energy. Watauga would have less geologic risk. Both have some seismic activity, but it's known seismic. Dams can be designed around seismic. They currently are being done in California and elsewhere. However, Chacachalma, one is with the Glacier Dam Lake, they are inherently unstable. You don't know when it's going to get around to releasing. It could be 10 years from now. It could be 50 years. But at some point, it could significantly affect how much water is in the storage. So also, you've got Mount Spur, and how Mount Spur would affect the operation at a future date is a little bit unknown. Watauga doesn't have a river diversion, so you get away from a lot of the headaches on that. Generally, we believe it's got less fisheries impacts because of the lack of salmon up at the location. There are a couple there, but we can discuss with the resource agencies in regards to that. There are salmon downriver on the Susitna River, but the Susitna River tends to be used as a highway or a transportation area for the salmon to go up the river and then go into other tributaries. And why some of them are in the sloughs, that has been looked at, and it will be looked at again with the fisheries people, resource agencies, in terms of how it'd be best handled. It's likely that Watauga can go through the licensing process quicker, and Chacachalma may require congressional action before it can get licensed. And Watauga has the possibility that you can always expand it for future growth and the demand for electrical on the rail belt. Chacachalma, you don't have that possibility. What I showed earlier on that slide about the wintertime energy, Watauga is able to provide significant amounts of wintertime energy, whereas Chacachalma cannot, and so that energy is going to be used to displace what gas is needed during the wintertime for generation, but that gas can be better used for home heating or otherwise. And the other part is that Watauga is necessary to achieve the state's 50% renewable goal. If you don't have a large hydro, it's extremely unlikely that you'll be ever able to make 50% renewable. Even with these, you may still have wind as 5 or 10%. You may have geothermal at 5 or 10%. And you've still got some of the other hydros, such as Bradley and Aklutna Lake. But they're not going to add up to the 50% of what the goal is. And so you really need a large hydroelectric project to provide both the dispatchable energy, stabilize the system, and get yourself to the renewable goal. So, from some of the public workshop meetings that we held, there's a lot of questions in regards to why Susitna is the only alternative. They wanted to look at little in cases of wind energy or solar or nuclear. The other potential sources of energy were not covered in a preliminary decision document, but they were covered in the integrated resource plan, and that looked at both the wind, geothermal, gas generation, coal generation, nuclear, and energy efficiencies. And so those numbers came out of the integrated resource plan to take a look at a lot of those. And under, depending on whether there's a carbon tax or not, depending on terms of what the growth rates of the rail belt are estimated at, you tend to come out with slightly different mixes over the years. But for the most part, you know, the amount of energy off of, unless you have the large hydro, it's most of the energy is going to be gas, and there will be some wind mixture in there, some energy efficiency upgrades that will be in there. There's also some questions about how much energy would cost. We are currently working on with a financial firm about coming up with better numbers on that. I do not see where the cost of energy is going to be really, it's not going to be where people see a rate shock that would occur, because realistically, if the cost of energy off the hydro project was going to be substantially more than, say, gas or otherwise, I don't think the utilities are going to be interested in receiving energy from a hydro project if it's going to cause their rates to go up. Talked a little bit about fisheries. There's a certain amount of concern about seismic. The seismic ground motions are fairly well understood by a lot of engineers. They currently build a lot of hydroelectric projects in seismic active areas of the world, such as, you know, California, or they haven't built one in California for a while, but overseas. And there's no record that we're aware of a modern dam failing because of a seismic event, an earthquake. Dams can get damaged in an earthquake just like any other infrastructure, but they're large structures that are tied together, reinforced, and they're designed for extremely large earthquakes. And so from that standpoint,
I have a question. Earlier you said that the utilities might not be interested in buying the power if it was at a certain price. At what point in the process do you determine those commitments? And how do, you know, when will we get that information, the legislature?
Madam Chair, I think that during the coming years we'd be having a lot of discussions with utilities about power sales agreements, and what, in terms of what the price would be to the utilities, will be a give and take in regards to what it ends up in terms of what the state participation would be and how it would be participated. And
Madam Chair, Sarah Fisher-Goad again, there's a lot of activity obviously that needs to happen, especially in a project of this size, and so there will be a variety of conversations that will start. There will be the engineering and the licensing process. Once we're able to file a preliminary permit application with FERC, that will then, you know, help us refine the timeline, refine the costs, and also the schedule. During that time, we'll also start having conversations with the utilities with respect to commitments to purchase the power. The one thing that we have started to do, and which we knew, it's one of these things where with the schedule with Susitna, we have engaged our financial advising firm that also worked on the integrated resource plan and has provided some background information for our preliminary decision document. We're engaging them on helping us with some calculation on some numbers and getting some better information sooner than we really had anticipated, but we know we need this information. And one thing that's happened through these discussions is we had one perhaps example using the Bradley model on what potentially the power cost could be. It was used as an example, and it is one that has had a great deal of questions that have come up, which has led us to know that we need to have our FA involved to kind of really refine those numbers a little bit and give us some more scenarios with respect to if the state's participation is at X, what could the wholesale power cost be? Because I know there has been questions coming from legislators on what's the power cost going to be to the retail ratepayers if this is built? And at this point, we don't know that answer, and it's not going to be, even with Bradley, the rate that Fairbanks residents pay is different than the rates that Anchorage residents pay through their utilities. So there's additional costs that are tacked on, of course, from the wholesale rate to their other energy costs by the time they receive the retail rate. So I think that we owe the legislature some additional information with respect to the costs. Some of that is not going to probably come this session, mainly because we do need to start the process and start having the conversations with utilities and then also, you know, with the engineers. So it's information that what I do want to do is, if we provide more information beyond this example, is that we have good information coming from our FAs and that give you a better idea. So again, we'll get that to the legislature as soon as possible, but we just don't have enough new information right now to give anything very concrete.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I do apologize. I was involved in something I had to be involved in, yet this is extremely important. Any of these energy discussions really shape whether our state kind of solves its problems or not, and for long periods of time. And I'm just trying to look at exactly where the impacts would be on these two different projects, and the cost, and that whole financial rewards, the costs in other ways as well. There are numbers of communities. Obviously, one has fewer communities involved than the other. But what I would love to know on these things is a bigger look at what it means longer term and what possibilities that might exist in some of these communities with a dam, with a changing of really the environment in certain areas, what impacts would affect the different communities that I know for sure in some of these that there are different ideas that people are working on, that that they may need land that gets tied up in the dam, for instance, in the case of the Susitna dam, or it's the Wantana?
Yes.
The Wantana dam, and I'm sorry, I hadn't heard that before, so that's new for me. But is there anything like that happening where we're really looking at it longer term with more of the resources in the picture and figuring out how we do it with that in the picture as well? I see the list of resources here for energy, but there's other things also, like agriculture, like other things that might be developed that it might affect.
Representative Sisna, through the chair, along with all the FERC studies or studies required for licensing, some of it is that there will be economic studies too in regards to how it would potentially or possibly affect the surrounding communities in regards to jobs or other things. And so at least that area, it would be studied at a future date.
Good.
So those are some of the effects. Other effects in regards to fisheries, siltation issues, or otherwise on a river would be studied as part of the licensing process. And, you know, the big part in regards to the mandatory condition of the resource agencies is they have the mission to protect the fisheries and the wildlife. And so they can put the conditions on the license to make sure that, one, the fisheries are protected for fishermen or otherwise to go fishing, and if they believe that there would be any negative impact, there's there's portions in the licensing where the licensee would be paying for enhancement or mitigation in terms of mitigation on could be for you could go out and acquire more wetlands area, mm-hmm. purchase wetlands. You could do funding for enhancement projects, or you could build a fish hatchery. So there's mm-hmm. a variety of methods that can be done.
Okay, one more question, and then we're going to try to wrap it up by 9 o'clock, and Representative Osterman had a question, too.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to just make a comment, if you don't mind, and that is that I'm getting educated like we all are and realizing oversight. Oftentimes we have changing players here in the legislature and in the administration and that kind of thing, and that if we can possibly get those kinds of that kind of information out and get it in a format that is understandable to new legislators that haven't been trained, and that we give ourselves a chance to really work for long term by understanding it, so that the oversight actually does happen, because unfortunately if you're new, you're not good at oversight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Osterman.
Well, that conversation sparked a lot of thoughts going through my brain. Number one is I totally support, at this point in time, Wantana and the concept of generating more hydro. And I look at the lifespan of a hydro project, 150, possibly 200 years, less the time that you have to change the turbines out. The problem that I get into is when Representative Sisna and Brian, you talked about mitigation of the salmon fisheries, that sparks flags going flying through my brains. When you talk about ag, pulling water off rag, that sparks all kinds of flags going through my brains, because I look at the Columbia River system down there, and that's exactly what the problem is down there, mm-hmm. is that they built those dams knowing they'd have to mitigate and destroy a salmon stream. They built those dams to draw water out of the system for ag and create a whole industry now that you can't take those dams out anymore, you can't take care of the problem. So be careful what you ask for, mm-hmm. because you might get a lot of opposition to a dam all to the hydro all of a sudden. So I'd be very cautious. My next question, my real question is $52 million, I think, that the governor has in the budget. Is that correct? Does that give you the funds to get started, similar to the money we put into looking at a in-state gas line? Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, the capital appropriation request in the governor's budget is approximately $65.7 million. What that number is derived from is the unobligated balance of the Rail Belt Energy Fund. So it's estimated to be $65.7 million. That does not give us enough money to complete the full licensing and design process. However, it gives us a start. And right now, our current estimate, and again, until we file with FERC and have the preliminary permit application, determining what studies we need and being able to refine that timeline. We do have an estimate that's been provided with that capital request, and I don't have it in front of me right now, but I believe it's approximately $20 million a year is needed for roughly $20 million a year for the environmental work that needs to be done, environmental and design. And again, we'll be refining that as we go. So, you know, it's a capital request that's not intended, of course, to we wouldn't be spending $65 million in FY 2012. This is a multi-year request to a fairly significant amount to get us going, but not quite enough to get us through the entire process.
Within that time frame, then, of the $65 million, at what point in time will you be able to come back to the legislature and say, it looks like it's X amount of dollars to build the thing. Looks like it's X amount of wholesale power that will be sold, and whether there's a mitigation, those types of questions. At what point in time during that $65 million will you come back to the legislature and give us the pertinent information that we will need to make a final decision?
Through the chair, Representative Osterman, I expect that we would have an opportunity every session to give the legislature additional information than the previous session. I think with respect to that, once we file the preliminary permit application, I think Brian's in a bit of a better position to know about when we can give you some better info.
Representative Osterman, through the chair. Currently, we are doing data gaps analysis on both wildlife and aquatics. The consultants are taking a look at all the old information and also looking at more recent information and changes in regulatory to find out what information is still going to be needed to decide in terms of what the potential impacts would be. Once we have these data gaps analysis finished, we'll meet with the resource agencies, and they'll go over it, and we'll have discussion in terms of what additional studies are needed. So until we get the data gaps analysis and receive the input from the resource agencies of what studies that they're going to be wanting, it's hard for us this year to be, in the next couple of months, to tell you in terms of how much some of the environmental studies are going to be, because it may be that environmental studies could be $10 million, they could be $30 million, or something like that. So at least from that standpoint, we will have a lot more information in a couple of months, which is what the resource agencies would want.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Brian and Sarah, we've heard some testimony on the Watana project in the Energy Committee, and one of the questions that was raised was the idea of reservoir-induced seismicity, pardon me, RIS. I did a little bit of research, a very little bit of research, and tried to find out what it is. And it seems to be the concept that if you build it, there will be an earthquake. Is there any, have you looked, I know you people want to ask you questions and expect you to have answers to every question, but does even the preliminary decision document consider the seismic conditions of this area? And is there anything to reservoir-induced seismicity? You try it.
Representative Sadler, to the chair. Most of the seismic activity that will occur when there's a new reservoir, you know, it's earth adjusting to a new weight, tends to be very small earthquakes. The sizes that might be what you'd think of as magnitude 1, 2, and so that most people would never even notice it, even if they're standing right on top of it. The controlling earthquake for many of these hydroelectric projects would be earthquakes that are located within 10 miles, and in most cases, in the case of Watana, would be likely to be a magnitude 8 on the Richter scale with less than 10 mile distance away. And so it's they tend to use these controlling earthquakes that are close earthquakes that are very large, and so the reservoir seismicity tends to be less than what a controlling earthquake would be.
Less than a control?
Less than what the design earthquake would be.
Okay. To follow up, more a comment. I fear that much the same way that an endangered species or critical habitat is discovered near every development project, I'm afraid that RIS would be generated seismic risk where one might not really exist. I don't know. And got followed by a different, on the same kind of lines and kind of relaying some of the questions we heard in Energy Committee, are there hydrological or geodetic studies to show if a dam were to leak, where the water would go and how fast a flow would be? My concern is for Talkeetna downstream.
Now, Representative Sadler, through the chair. One, in regards to if there is to be water coming out of the dam as part of the FERC licensing process that is studied to come up with, you know, estimates in terms of both time and how much water would come down, because there's Talkeetna is approximately 90 miles downriver, mm-hmm. and so the water flow is going to get constrained going through Devil Canyon, and which will tend to hold back some of the water, and then it'll spread out. So there was work done back in the 1980s about how fast it would go down and in what areas it would flood. That would be required under new licensing. However, for the most part these days, FERC normally doesn't look at too much of a catastrophic failure of a dam because it just doesn't occur where it suddenly goes away and you have a huge wall coming down. Mm-hmm. You can have some type of release from a dam from a much smaller type of failure. It's not it's not the entire reservoir going down. It may be a smaller amount. And so that's what they tend to look at more these days, as being a more likely occurrence. And so, but that will be additionally studied during the next couple of years, and that's required.
And I guess I'll say also for the record that I'm intrigued by this possibility. It's very attractive to me in a lot of ways, but there's a lot of concerns and some legitimate fears, some not so legitimate, but we need to make sure and address them for the public.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah and Brian, very much for your testimony and for your presentation. And I want to thank Representative Gardner for bringing the request forward to have this discussion. It's been very enlightening. Thank you very much. And we are now adjourned. It's 5 minutes after 9 o'clock.